Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:30, and that's Pacific Summer Time. And today is May 6th, and it's Big Friday. It's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we have a review of what's been happening this week, well, it was generally a soft week on stock markets, and that, by and large, helped to unwind the overbought condition that was evident at the beginning of the week on the majority of stock markets, and that's really been going on now for the last 2 weeks. So as we approach and into Friday, what we've seen on the S&P is that it has steadied around the 2050 area, and that's where the progression of higher reaction lows is. It's really just above the region of the moving average, and I think it is worth pointing out that the moving average is less important in a market that has been ranging and has been both above and below the MA over the course of the last year. We've often defined, and it was a question that came in earlier this week about, you know, really what's the best way to use the moving average, and the way we consider it is that it is a trend mean, and therefore, it's most appropriate to use when there is a well-defined trend. And then if you actually look at what you're presented with on Wall Street, then you have to conclude that the market is no longer trending higher, that this has been a range that's been going on now for the last almost 18 months. And you know, for years, we've been describing the rally on Wall Street as liquidity-fueled. And with the Fed having now completed its taper and raised interest rates once, then the supply of additional liquidity into the market has been curtailed, and the size of the Fed's balance sheet has not contracted. It's exactly the same as it was this time a year and a half ago, but that means that they're rolling forward their debt when it matures, but they're not adding new money. And there is a very clear correlation there. So that helps to bolster the argument this is a liquidity-fueled rally. And of course, what are the organs of that liquidity? And I think that that really is worth considering, because it was share buybacks. It was the absolute rock-bottom availability of credit. So you look at, you know, what people are taught in MBA programs in terms of corporate governance and corporate finance, and it is very simple that when debt is cheap, you take out debt. When equity is cheap, you take out equity. When equity is cheap, you borrow and pay back your debt. When you've got earnings, you pay back your debt. When you've got very cheap debt, you buy back your equity. And that's exactly what they've been doing. And it's despite the fact that somebody can look at any of the companies where they've been buying back shares for the last 6 and 7 years and say, well, prices up here aren't particularly attractive if you're buying back your own shares. But that doesn't really matter, because debt is so remarkably inexpensive now relative to equity that it just makes sense for companies to buy it back regardless of really what the price is. Now, obviously, if you have a finite amount of money to use to buy back shares, you get to buy back an awful lot more of them when prices are lower than they are than when they're higher. So it isn't so much about whether share buybacks make sense or not, but rather how much money is being allocated to share buyback programs. And, well, one of the factors that has created this pullback over the last couple of weeks has been that earnings have not come in at the same expectations that people have had. And if earnings are not performing, then the amount of money available to buy back shares is likely to be curtailed. And because share buybacks and borrowing to pay dividends has been one of the primary drivers of this bull market and has been perhaps the primary organ of transmission of very loose monetary policy to investors, then what happens to bonds is very important. Now, I'm posting a chart today of double B spreads, and I think it really is worth considering, because it looks increasingly like that the path of least resistance for double B spreads is to go higher from here. And right now they're trading at about 4% or 400 basis points over treasuries. And they haven't really traded around these levels since 2011. And and in between 2011 and now, you were presented with this saucering shape, which is generally consistent with accumulation. But in this case, it would be dissipation, that there is additional risk being priced into the high-yield bond market. And this is really a pivotal time, because if we start to see yields moving higher from here in the junk bond markets, well, that's going to represent, this is where you would anticipate that that would start to happen, because this is where the progression of higher reaction lows, or the region at least, is for that chart. And then when you look at, for example, the commodity index, the continuous commodity index, or the Asian dollar index, then you've seen that these very deep oversold conditions have been unwound. That the oversold condition on the junk bond index has been unwound. So the S&P 500 is now at 2050, and if it is going to hold this level, well, then the chances are that the majority of those other indices I've just mentioned will also hold their levels. But what we have seen this week, and it was perhaps the most important thing that has happened this week, is a substantial dollar rally. And that was particularly powerful against the commodity currencies. So yes, the dollar rallied against the euro, and the euro has fallen 2 cents against the dollar this week, and the pound has pulled back from its highs after a pretty impressive rally. But the Australian dollar moved really quite abruptly, and that was helped along by the RBA cutting interest rates and then opening up the path that they may actually cut again. And the Canadian dollar has also pulled back really quite sharply, and then people are starting to look at oil prices and really questioning just how much further, much higher they're likely to go, that the easy part of the rally has now taken place. So now we have to consider then, what is it that has really helped to ignite interest in the US dollar? Well, we have a corrective environment, generally speaking, on stock markets, and that's following what has been really quite an impressive rally. And then the dollar is at the lower side of its range on the dollar index, which is primarily euro and yen, but it has been trending lower really against some currencies for the last 3 or 4 months, and then it has now staged a rally. But you really have to break it up into different baskets, because both the Eurozone and Japan are implementing deflationary policies by introducing negative interest rates. And one really has to question why they're doing that. Because if you put in negative interest rates and you also have regulations that inhibit banks from lending, then that's directly deflationary. And that's one of the reasons that you've had the move higher in their respective currencies, because they're no longer issuing additional quantities of them, but also that you've had this really quite sharp pullback in their respective stock markets. And Japan in particular has pulled back really very sharply, and it's now actually back in a region of potential support. So if it's going to find support, then it's probably going to do it next week. Then the Eurozone is certainly not expensive, but it has substantial challenges. And of course, those are the reasons why it is not as expensive, and it hasn't rallied as impressively as Wall Street, for example. Now, then what do we have to gain by looking at all of this? The most important aspect is bond markets. Because, and that is why we have such enormous concentration on it, what exactly is it that the Fed is likely to do. Because there's increasing speculation that they will not raise interest rates this year. And if that's the case, that should act as a tailwind to risk assets. if they go ahead and raise interest rates, then that will represent an additional headwind for the liquidity-fueled rally. The extent to which they can raise interest rates is likely to not just be a U.S. consideration, but rather they're going to have to look at the rest of the world and decide just how strong do they want the U.S. dollar to be. Well, the dollar is not expensive at today's level, considering that it has pulled back so sharply over the last 7 and 8 weeks. And isn't it interesting that it is when the euro is firm that Europe tends to do best? And it was during a substantial dollar pullback that Wall Street rallied rather impressively. And now we'll see just how far or to what extent the Wall Street can sustain those gains in an environment where it's looking increasingly likely that we are going to be moving into a period of time where the dollar gets progressively firmer. Then when you look around the broad market, the rally that we had in commodity currencies for the last 6 months, which was very much in tune with the reversionary rally that we had in the oil price, has probably now come to an end. Those prices have got strong enough, and then we really have to look at what is it that is there any particular reason that the dollar was weak? And I think that's a very relevant question, because was it really a case that these currencies had gone down too much and were strengthening against the dollar, or was it more a weak dollar argument? And I think it was more that the commodity currencies, the emerging markets, had been trending lower for not just the last few months, but for the last few years, and hit important medium-term lows at the beginning of this year, and then staged really quite an impressive reversionary rally. There's every likelihood that we're going to move into now, at worst, I suspect, base formation development for the majority of those currencies. And that would suggest that if you were looking for currencies against which the dollar can rally impressively, then it's unlikely to be emerging market currencies or commodity currencies, because they've already trended lower in a meaningful way over the last 4 and even 5 years. So a lot of that move has already occurred. In fact, it's increasingly likely that commodity currencies will probably trend higher over the medium term against the US dollar, but not right now. Right now, they're unwinding what is really quite a large overextension or overbought condition, and some of those currencies are quite likely to go right back down and test their respective lows. And the extent to which they can hold above those lows is likely to be very much dictated by governance. Well, then you look at the US economy, and they've made the greatest reforms in terms of the financial sector. And they forced the banks into foreclosures, and they forced the banks to accept the bad loan situation. And as a result, the U.S. economy was perhaps the first to go into crisis, but it is the first to also be coming out. So over the medium term, when you start comparing the U.S. economy to Europe or to Japan, then there's a strong likelihood that it is going to continue to outperform. And it has substantial advantages that, for example, Europe does not have, in that it is largely has the capacity to become energy independent. And obviously that is going to depend on the continued expansion of oil production, the continued expansion of electric vehicle usage, and just how is it that they're going to legislate for autonomous vehicles, where I think it was news today that it was Lyft and General Motors are talking about building an autonomous taxi. So then that would help to take some of the cars off the road, and because it would improve sharing. Now they might come back as usage increases, but generally speaking, that would be good for the USA's energy deficit. And Europe is a major energy importer, and that represents a substantial drain which the US has the capacity, at least, to unwind. And if you look at North America as a whole, then if you include Canada, then there is quite a strong possibility that North America could become energy independent. And then that doesn't even begin to think about the technological advantage that the USA has. The fact today that IBM is now beginning to sell its quantum computer as a service, and the fact that it is one of the leaders in big data and big data as a service, that's really powerful in terms of the kinds of services that can be provided to consumers, and it is a further iteration of this transition away from the manufacturing sector overall and towards a much greater emphasis on services. Now, those are the kinds of things that can help to drive a secular bull market, where technological innovation really is accelerating, where the capacity for really quite incredible innovation in the energy sector, in the biotech sector or medical overall, and indeed in just regular consumer electronics, then that is the kind of thing that can help to drive a secular bull market. Just how we get over the hump of a normalizing monetary policy is the big unknown, because there are a number of very extreme situations that have developed in the debt markets over the last 6 and 7 years that we simply do not know the answer as to how we are going to unwind them. And then you have to start thinking about the complacency that you get in crowds, the tolerance for contradiction that is evident in every crowd, and that it's especially during the mania phase of major bull markets that contradiction is most evident. So you know, in the late 1990s, people, it wasn't just that people said that earnings don't matter, they really believed it. And before the credit crisis, people really believed that they could use credit default swaps to hedge default risk for everybody. But we know now that somebody has to bear the default risk. And the situation that we've had over the last 7 and 8 years, that the quantity of debt can increase exponentially, indefinitely, and that you don't have to worry about credit risk, that is going to get tested. And there is absolutely no question that it isn't going to get tested at some stage. And when it does, that is going to represent a massive crash. And that is likely to be when the next crash that we're likely to experience occurs. Now, perhaps more important than that is when. And right now, there is no evidence of that. Maynard Keynes said that markets can stay rational longer than you can stay solvent. Irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And certainly there is an irrationality to that supposition that no one has to worry about credit risk. And that will not always be the case. And so now that we know what the contradiction in the market is, we know what the problem is likely to be. And it's going to feel like the boy who cried wolf, warning about this kind of thing until it actually becomes obvious and accepted, because it'll become a real clear and present danger. But until then, then we would be absolutely remiss not to to keep that in mind. And then what is interesting is that with commodity currencies bottoming, and certainly, as I said, they are overbought in the short term, there is potential for them to pull back further, and then they'll probably rally again. But gold prices have now broken their medium-term downtrend, and they've been consolidating that break of the downtrend for the last 4 months. And they pulled back a little bit in the beginning of the week and firmed towards the end of the week. And this continues to look like nothing more than a first step above the Type 2 bottom. And interesting that I've seen speculation about where is it that gold prices are likely to go, ranging from multiples of where prices are now to fractions of where prices are now. And realistically, there is nobody knows where prices are going to go on from one day to the next. But what we can say is that anytime we've seen this kind of pattern before, it has been a pattern of accumulation. And that it looks more likely than not that we are going to see prices trend higher from here. And realistically, we would need to see some major improvement in the fundamentals for gold if we were to see all-time new highs in the next couple of years. But that doesn't mean that we can't have an impressive medium-term rally. And for the first time in nearly a decade, the mining sector is offering leverage to the gold price. So they went through before the bull market that began in 2001, 2002, they'd gone through 20 years where they had no money to invest in new mines. So when prices started doing better, they invested every spare penny in trying to build out their capacity. And it meant they had no free cash flow, and they were unable to return any of their profits to their shareholders, and their shares really underperformed the gold price. And on top of that, ETFs sapped investor demand by offering an alternative. Well, right now, they've gone through this painful rationalization over the last few years. And now they're at a position where they're no longer spending money on expanding. And every time prices go higher, it turns into additional profits that can be returned to shareholders. So gold shares are now offering upside, or they're offering leverage to the gold price. And that's the same thing with both silver and platinum, where they have both been trading at relative discounts to the gold price on a historic basis. And platinum in particular is currently trading at 1,082, and gold prices are at 1,289. So that's a $200 discount for what in many people's eyes is the more valuable metal. Now, obviously, there are long-term issues that platinum has to overcome, and not least that electric car usage continues to evolve, and electric cars don't have a catalytic converter. And since anti-pollution devices is the primary use of platinum, then that's likely to inhibit the metal's ability to rally in a meaningful way over the medium term. But certainly in the short term, it has ample opportunity to go higher from here. Now, with the generally positive tone on commodities, then it really is worth highlighting that when you get commodities moving from the biggest underperformer to the biggest outperformer, well, that's generally indicative that we're in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market. Doesn't mean we're at the end of a secular bull market, but we're certainly in the final innings of a medium-term move. And that means that we would not be looking at the commodity sector to lead on the downside. That it's a lagging indicator, it's an indicator that tells us we're in the latter stages, but that commodity shares will probably peak well after the wider market. And now they're coming from very depressed levels, so I think people are still underweight. A lot of investors have been really badly burned by the commodity sector, and yet it continues to improve. So what we've had is a reasonable pullback now in companies over the last few weeks, and not least BHP Billiton, Rio Tinto, and their ability to find support and to hold the progression of higher reaction lows will, I think, do a lot to really help to bolster confidence that there is the potential for a medium-term move on the upside from here. Well, if that is an indicator that we are late in the cycle, then we have to really keep an eye on where it is that we are in terms of the medium-term trends that we have in stock markets, because I continue to have this high conviction that we are at the beginning of a secular bull market, but that that there's no way to get around the fact that markets have already been going up for nearly 7 years. And then if that's the case, there is every possibility that we could go through a period of time where markets range and volatility picks up. And we've already had a year of that, and we might have another year of it. And realistically, we've been susceptible to bouts of volatility that have been the result of high-frequency trading and ETF pricing models really not passing muster. But and there is no reason to believe that that isn't going to happen again in future. So occasional bouts of volatility, I think, are to be expected. And it would be the absolute best possible scenario that the S&P finds support at 2050 and then pushes on and sustains a move to new high ground. But how likely that is, and personally I would put that at about a 20% possibility right now, for the simple reason that valuations simply do not support the view that an all-time high is justifiable, or that it would encourage people to pay all-time high values. And since the NASDAQ led on the upside and then it has been leading on the downside, I think if you're looking for a lead indicator of performance in the stock market, then we probably need to look at the NASDAQ and keep a close eye on that, because some of the largest companies in the world, I think it's 5 of the 6 largest companies in the world right now, are in the technology sector. So, what happens on the NASDAQ is going to have a substantial impact on wider markets. Of course, that also tells us that it's the technology sector is really where the value is being created. It's where the real potential for productivity growth is likely to occur. Then if we just go through the three main arguments for why there might be a secular bull market evolving, despite that we have sort of short to medium term risks, they are that we do have this technological innovation that is really just transforming lives. And it isn't just that we have innovation, but that the availability of that innovation is now global. And we have energy prices that have pulled back and have subsequently rallied, and oil prices are up in excess of 70% at this stage from their lows. But just how high those oil prices are likely to go is inhibited by technological innovation, by the kind of innovation that we're getting in solar, the innovation that we're getting in the energy sector itself, which is allowing more wells to be drilled at a lower cost, and supply coming onto the market that was really never possible before. But also that solar technology is improving, that the efficiency of solar cells is increasingly applicable to Moore's law, so that we can anticipate that they will get progressively more efficient. And then the innovation that we're getting in the nuclear sector, with Generation 4 type reactors already getting built in places like China. Well, that has the potential to really help to innovate. And on an energy density basis, innovation in the nuclear sector really does have a transformative effect. Then when you look at the potential for fusion to become reality, well, they're building the ITER reactor, fusion reactor, in the south of France, and they probably won't be finished building it for at least another 5 years, but it'll be the first, and hopefully the first working fusion reactor. And then in an environment where you have cheap, abundant energy, then, and that isn't necessarily dependent on fossil fuel, the necessity for oil prices to stay high is really quite unlikely. So then this rally hasn't ended quite yet, and it would really require a pullback on Brent crude of more than $6 to indicate that supply is beginning to get the upper hand. But then what we're more likely to see is ranging, and natural gas offers a really good template for that, because natural gas spiked higher, pulled back, and has really ranged at relatively depressed levels compared to where the peak values were for the last 4 and 5 years. Well, if we're going to have cheap energy and technological innovation and availability of that technology improving, the fact that governance is improving in a number of major population centers is very positive. And India, Indonesia, even Nigeria and Brazil are really leading the charge there. And I don't think we could, it's been touch and go whether one could say that governance was improving or disimproving in China for a while. But just the way that developments are shaping out, particularly over the last 6 months, I think you would be hard-pressed to say that governance is improving now in China. And then that represents an additional risk. There's, if governance is no longer improving, then everything else has to be a lot better. And maybe that's not the case either. So if we really are looking for what are the potential risks, then China and what's happening there in terms of the Communist Party's desire to do anything to hold on to power, and not just power, but to control every aspect of people's lives, then that is a potential risk. That is something that really does need monitoring, because they've been pretty ham-fisted in exactly what it is they're doing with the economy, and they absolutely botched the opening of the options market last year. It created a short-term bubble and a short-term bust, and the market is still convalescing from it. And then the opening up of peer-to-peer lending just last year has and was done with no regulation at all, so that there's over 1,000 of them have gone to the wall just in the last year. And they've even been closing their offices and banning anyone from opening a company with financial anything in the title, just to try and stop mass protests at the amount of money that people have lost. So, you know, then when you start looking at these types of events, it's very difficult to conclude that governance is improving. In fact, you'd have to say it's getting worse, and that's not good news. That really does suggest that China represents an additional risk to not just itself, but to the global economy, that was perhaps not so much of a factor just a year ago. Then we start looking around at the other major population centers. We can still conclude that governance is getting better in places like India, in Indonesia, even in Nigeria, and even in Brazil. It's looking increasingly likely that Dilma Rousseff is going to be indicted or impeached, and that I think it was Cunha who had actually run against her for the presidential in the presidential election has also been thrown out, because I think it's more than half of their politicians are tainted with some form of corruption. But the fact that they're even being brought to trial is really positive. But then you look at the Middle East, and it's very hard to conclude that things are getting better. That Erdogan in Turkey, you know, that his prime minister asked to be allowed to get on and do his job, so he got fired. You know, that's a deterioration. And what we really do have to bear in mind is that when we look at emerging markets in particular, then the currency is perhaps the best voting machine that there is. So you really do have to keep an eye on what is happening with those currencies, and whether you can just ask simple questions like, is it trending or ranging? Is there any evidence, or is it a consistent trend? And is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend endings? Because for the Turkish lira, there is no evidence that that currency has stopped going down. Whereas if you look at the Brazilian real, I think you could make a fairly good argument that at least a medium-term low has been found. And that really does have to shape our view. One thing that short-term or even medium-term moves in the market will not stop is from young people getting older. And then we do have this boom in the global population against a background where governance is improving, which increases the potential for people to reach their productive capacity. And if that's the case, then they will get access to the technology. They will want to consume just about more of just about everything. And that really is the kind of thing that can drive a secular bull market. But right now, we are in a more risky kind of environment. And then taking big bets is not what we see any evidence of anyone else doing either. That by and large, what we've seen is that shares that were really high-flying have been pegged back, and those that have pulled back a lot are beginning to find support. So people are being judicious on what they're buying. And I think more than any time in the last 7 years, it is really worth your time to monitor the consistency of trends and to ask yourself whether you have you see any evidence of trend ending. And then if you conclude that you do, when what would you do about it? So it is, and I think that that is perhaps the most important thing anyone can do. If things are still trending consistently in this particular kind of environment, well then the imbalance between supply and demand really must have something that is very powerful supporting it. But if you see massive inconsistencies, and then you really do have to ask big questions. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.